hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. We're coming to you live this morning, deep from deep within your local anarchist jurisdiction here in Portland, proudly flying our anarchist colors this morning, proudly defiant of the federal government who, I don't know, is miffed with us for some reason. I don't know. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners.
Thank you for tuning in this morning. This is the Abe and Joe Talk radio program on KDOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. If you're listening on one of the internet tubes, you should aim it at KDOO.FM. I also want to remind people that we are in the midst of KDOO's fall membership drive. We need your support now more than ever before. Visit that aforementioned website, KDOO.FM, and click on the donate button to support community radio in this most interesting of times. Tracy, how does it feel to be part of an anarchist jurisdiction? I'm kind of liking it.
I mean, wow, you know, I do put different colored, you know, gender-neutral stuff on my animals. I had a wonderful Sunday brunch outside, and there was no looting or, I mean, I don't know. Is it really an anarchist area? I'm just like, what is the point of this? And I have to think that there's something behind it. So whether it's going to be that, you know, we are defunded by the federal government and no support will come our way, I'm kind of okay with that. Of course, we need the money in a pandemic and all of the things that are happening. That would be great. But also that kind of Cascadia ideology, we're going to just, you know, break off from the larger United States. You know, I don't know. It's sounding better and better every day.
Yeah, I went to brunch this weekend, you know, hoping I could get a front row seat to some of the anarchy, but I was kind of disappointed. Things were pretty sedate. The air was actually clean. You know, there wasn't chaos and destruction all around me. It was disappointing. I was a little let down, actually. You know, you think you're named an anarchist jurisdiction. You think this is where the action is. But, you know, just brunch. So, to dig in a little farther about this, what does being an anarchist jurisdiction mean? Well, nobody really knows. This is the product of some initial bluster by our president, Donald Trump, which was then maybe polished to a little more of a bluster luster by our attorney general, who declared over the declared that New York, Seattle, and Portland were, quote, permitting anarchy, Barr said. And this, of course, was on the heels of Trump's declaration that these three local governments, quote, are permitting anarchy, violence, and destruction in American cities. I don't know really what to say about that. I think this is yet another round of posturing from this administration designed to do nothing more than ensure that his voters perceive the world exactly the way he wants them to perceive it.
Yeah, I really do. I think it's just more fear-mongering and really trying to get people scared of something, right? We don't know what, because those of us who live in Portland are like, oh, no, actually, we were just inside for like a week because of the fires and the bad air quality. Like, there's been nothing really going on. And even if you think about the protests that have been going on for a long time, the numbers of people have greatly subsided. And so, you know, Portland, as long as I've lived here, has always had, a small level of vandalism or, you know, graffiti, really. But other than that, it's a very safe place to live. I never worry about walking outside my door and what's going to befall me. And so the idea that this is fear-mongering, this scaring people into something that really is nothing, and because it's been labeled as so, it's going to serve that purpose, is really frightening. It's really frightening.
Yeah, it's really frightening, and it's more than a little silly. That's the in the final analysis. The litany of reasons that Barr ran down when describing why these various jurisdictions, are anarchists, hotbeds of anarchy. He talked about these jurisdictions doing some of the things that the Black Lives Matter movement has called for with regard to the funding and organization of police departments. Barr talked about the New York government transferring certain police functions, including school safety, out of the NYPD. He talked about Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo, who have forcefully rejected federal law enforcement support. Here in Portland, he cited the fact that in June, we voted to slash $15 million from our police budget, paring that budget down to a really, really lean $240 million. And in Seattle, he cited the Capitol Hill Occupy protest, which for a hot minute, was this self-described anarchist haven on top of Capitol Hill of Seattle. So, clearly all three of these cities are a looming threat to democracy as we know it, and really deserve to be singled out by the president.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I think even more so than just even singling out, it's creating that further division, right? Like those people over there. And it really is about, when there are mass protests and people stand up, and I've said this before, right? The death of the status quo as it is when people fully reject the subjugation of their community members and other citizens, right? But as long as we have people who are willing and are frightened to stand up on behalf of somebody else's rights, meaning not their own rights necessarily, but if you are, in cases, a white person who stands up and says, yes, Black lives do matter, and you're willing to walk in the street and protest and be gassed by the police, you're showing a different level of commitment that cannot stand for the patriarchy, right? And so there's this tamping down of public unrest in the process of saying, yeah, you don't want to be like these people, right? Because as soon as you become like these people, you are contesting everything that we stand for. And, I saw this interesting little statement saying that, Republicans, they want to let you know that they are not racist and not fascist, but they're also anti-racist, or against anti-racist and against anti-fascist. So you have to decide, what does this mean? And I really do believe this is just one of the continual kind of checking off the box as we slide into more of a fascist bent in our society. It's scary stuff. It's funny at the, on the higher level. I've been laughing about it and making jokes about it with my boy kitten and his pink collar, but also really kind of also thinking deeply about what does this even mean, and what will this mean in the future. So to use this as a tool to take back money, take back support, and continually create that division and hold up Portland or Seattle or New York as a model of what other places don't want to be, where in actuality, while the fires were going on, the Antifa was gathering resources and support for victims of the fires, mm-hmm. and delivering mutual aid and water and feeding birds, but we're what people don't want to be. That's sort of scary. It's frightening.
You're right. It's one thing to sit back and laugh at the obvious absurdity of it all. It's quite another thing to recognize it as yet another milepost of passing us by on our road to fascism. You're right. We should not be so above it all as to think this is merely another silly distraction from the president. It's not. It's deadly serious. And I'm glad you mentioned the word patriarchy, because this all smacks of paternalism, doesn't it? Trump's saying that Portland's among the jurisdictions he's now classed as anarchist because of our refusal to accept federal aid. And I'm putting air quotes around the word aid here, because we all know that federal aid means, armed and armored goons who come in here to beat on Portlanders. And we saw that for weeks and weeks and weeks on end here in this city. So it's very much like the father who's spanking his kid and saying, this is for your own good and this hurts me more than it hurts you. No thanks, Dad. No, we don't need your discipline. We don't need your goons. And, we're happy to wear this badge that you've slapped upon us here. Because if this is the way Trump and his people don't want to be, then that leads me to believe that we're on the right track.
A.B. of Allen on the line.
I understand we have a caller. So let's jump to the phones, and then we'll move on to talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Alan.
Hi, Alan. What's on your mind? Okay, we'll come back to Alan
when
we get the opportunity. Are you there, Alan?
We lost him.
Oh, we lost him. Okay. Well, Alan, give it another try. We'll be happy to talk to you. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also leave a comment at our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/AveandJoe. Tracy, as I just mentioned before our attempt to connect with our caller, last week, the venerable and much revered Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, leaving our future in an even more uncertain state than it was before. What is there left to say about our RBG? A titan, a feminist icon, a great American in every sense of the word.
So, you know, I will just say that it's pretty obvious what's going to happen, right? I mean, she probably was still twitching when McConnell got out there and said that there will be a vote. Her party probably wasn't cold just yet. And it's nasty, and from a humanist perspective, it's nasty, but even more so in, you know, people will call it hypocrisy, but I can't even call it hypocrisy. We knew who we were dealing with, right? And so we just know that this will absolutely be politicized as part of the upcoming election. We know with the situation with Merrick Garland and there being almost 10 months to the election that Obama was not allowed to bring forth or get a vote for his nominee. And this will be rushed through. Right now, the top choice, as I've heard it be referred to, is Amy Coney Barrett, I believe is how you say her name. And, you know, she is a strong candidate for the right. And so we know that things are on the line right now that will cause everyone to come out and vote. And we also know that in places where people are more progressive, people are more concentrated with people of color, so cities, that there has been an onslaught of voter suppression. And so it makes me very, very nervous about the next few months, that even if, say, Trump loses the election, he will still have the lame duck and the ability to push through a new person on the bench. And so, you know, I think one of our callers last week, referred to, you know, Democrats kind of playing t-ball when others are, you know, coming with hammers and guns. And at this point, it's like we have to, like, be able to, you know, put everything out there, drop the gauntlet, because there has to either be an expansion of the court, there has to be an expansion of the state, when we think about D.C. and Puerto Rico, because literally everything is on the line. Voting rights is on the line. Women's right to choose their own health care, right? We always say abortion, but it's really health care we're talking about. Women's right to choose what their bodies do and what they do with their bodies. We know that all of the civil rights legislation is on the line. We know that there's this kind of ideology around the religious right, and that will likely be pushed through with this person in that slot. And so the person and their ideological bent is, you know, really the complete opposite of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so you will have a very far-right court in a country that is progressing so much faster than the people who are holding power want it to. And so it's going to be a challenging time, even if Biden did win. If Trump wins, goodbye democracy. That's all I will say. So, and I would love to hear what you're thinking about this, Abe.
Well, I have to agree with you with the entirety of what you said. This imperils not only the obvious issue, which of course is the vulnerability of Roe v. Wade to being overturned by the court, but as you mentioned, to a whole slate of progressive priorities going forward. The best case scenario here, and yes, progressive listeners, this is an unacceptable best case scenario, but here it is. Joe Biden wins the presidency and the Democrats win the Senate, the table would be set there for the enactment of a range of progressive legislative priorities, almost all of which we know will be, first of all, opposed procedurally in Congress, and secondly, challenged in the courts. So we're going to see what amounts to with this court, with a 6-3 conservative majority. We're going to look at a court that essentially has permanent veto power over any host of pieces of progressive legislation that may come down the pike. And I'm using the term progressive in the broadest sense here. Legislation designed to expand access to health care, reproductive rights, to generally bring more of the country under what we broadly consider to be progressive governments, environmental decisions, and so on. That gives them essentially a permanent 6-3 majority. And as you mentioned, it's really tempting to get caught up in the obvious hypocrisy of it all. But as you mentioned, you scratch a little deeper and it's not hypocrisy at all. Everybody who was paying attention knew that when Mitch McConnell stole that Supreme Court nomination from President Obama, mm-hmm. That he was lying through his teeth, that the decision was all about power, expanding and maintaining conservative power in Washington. And that was all it was. And we all knew that with the shoe on the other foot, McConnell would, again, act in the interest of his own power and that of his party. And that is exactly what he's doing. So far from being hypocritical, he's being completely consistent. Now, the problem, of course, is that's absolutely unacceptable in a society that values representative democracy and democratic governance. The Republicans and conservatives in general retired the concept of hypocrisy a long time ago. They make decisions with one consideration in mind only, and that is, how will this decision pave my way to the acquisition of more power, and how will it attempt me to entrench the power that I already have? We need to start understanding the Republican Party in those terms. And the Republican Party, as it exists under Donald Trump, this tendency, I think, is only magnified. That's how we need to start understanding these people going forward. And that's why we need to start, as progressives, we need to start bringing guns to gunfights that we find ourselves in. What this means in the context of this Supreme Court decision, in the context of this new justice who will most certainly be appointed before the election, and if not before the election, before the inauguration of the president in early next year, this is going to happen. We need to accept that this is going to happen. So what the Democrats... as the imperfect tools of progressives, what Senate Democrats need to do, and Democrats in Congress, is if we win control of the Senate, expand the court. This is the only way to ensure enacting the kind of legislation that's going to stand a chance of steering us out of this societal cul-de-sac in which we now find ourselves. It's the only hope for progressive environmental legislation, for progressive health legislation, for labor rights, for the rights of traditionally underserved communities, of immigrants, of trans people, of undocumented folks, and on and on and on and on. It's the only way.
Abe Allen
now,
is
people,
back.
Traditionalists are going to wring their hands. They're going to clutch their pearls and say this is unprecedented. Well, you know what else is unprecedented? Stealing a Supreme Court nomination from a sitting president.
And then not following one's own rules. That they used
yes,
to do that.
Indeed. Yeah, there's nothing illegal or unconstitutional about expanding the number of justices on the Supreme Court. Now, we all know that there are positive and negative ways to go about this. The famous case in point being FDR and his attempt to pack the court during the Great Depression. That was I think, quantitatively and qualitatively different situation than what we find ourselves in now. So what we need to do as progressives is demand this going forward. Not as the price of acquiescence to conservative prerogatives now, but as something that needs to happen, that is inevitable and necessary for the continued health of our republic. So that's what we need to do, and we need to push for that on every front possible. Now, did I hear that right, Engineer Ty? Do we have a call?
Yes, Alan is back.
Alan is back. Good morning, Alan. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Good morning. What a wonderful program. You guys do a great job. And I've been a listener for many years, and I appreciate it. You know, we need a voice of the people on the radio, and luckily, KBOO and you guys provide it. I have one question, and this mm-hmm. question is to Abe, and you were asked this question last week, and I'm afraid to say your answer didn't seem very forthright. And the question is, mm-hmm. what happened to Joe Uris? Because I've been listening to him before you, and as a listener-supported radio station, I believe we have a right to know what happened to him, because a lot of listeners, I think, forgive my presumption, but a lot of listeners are kind of worried about what happened to him. He's not a young guy, and we need some kind of please, you know, give us some background on why he's no longer with KABU.
Well, let me reassure you and all of our listeners that Joe is in fine health. I spoke to him last week. He's doing fine. As for the details of why he's no longer with the program or with the station, as I've said before, I feel that's not my story to tell. I feel that I need to respect Joe's privacy on that matter.
That's his
there's
wish,
a statement
mean?
From
his wish is not Pardon? To tell why he's no longer with the program?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Is that Joe's wish, not to say why he's not with the program?
I guess I have to conclude that it is. He has the option of making a statement to his listeners, and so far he's elected not to do that. And again, that's his business and his decision. So I'm going to respect Joe's privacy on this issue. Again, it's not my story to relate to you, but I can assure you that he's in good health.
Okay. Well, that thank you for telling me that. I feel much better knowing that, because I know a lot, not only myself, but a lot of listeners have been worried about him, and we miss his insights and his, his explanations of historical events and putting them into the context of what's happening now. So anyway, okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, where were we? Yes, expanding the Supreme Court. I think that it's something that's going to have to happen, not just in the sense that it would right this historic wrong that was the theft of that Supreme Court seat, that it would sort of balance the cosmic scales of justice just a little bit. Yes, it would do those things. But more importantly, it would enable us to govern ourselves out of the dire situation that we're in.
Yeah. And I think some people think of it as like, oh, that's going nuclear, or, you know, and it's like, no, it's within the rules, just like, you know, pushing a nominee through during the election, right before the election, or potentially right after an election, is also within the rules, right? So let's play by the rules, and let's do what needs to be done, because right now, I think this kind of amassing power in any way possible, whether that's through voter suppression, whether that's through, this act that literally people are on record saying that they would not support, that they hold me to my words, you know, whether we're talking about Lindsey Graham or Chuck Grassley or others who said at the time that they blocked Merrick Garland, that they would hold themselves to their own rules. And now are not, you know, there just is no other option. There really is no other option. And for the sake of really being the nation that we want to be, not the nation that we were, you know, 50 years ago before Roe v. Wade, there has to be a little more balance. Because even when I think about the makeup of the court, is that really the makeup of the nation? There are a lot of people with, political ideologies, a lot of people with religious ideologies, who are using, you know, that as a basis to, you know, make judgments on a whole nation, and it doesn't feel representative, right? There aren't representative voices in that space, and so expanding the court brings in the opportunity to bring in some more representative voices.
Yeah, I agree, and all of this is, I think, begging a pretty glaring question, which is what sort of system do we have when the death of one one progressive member of the judiciary affects the reproductive fate of more than half of the United States? Right, that is an inherently, what's the word I'm looking for? Flawed, for sure, But, you know, confounding and frustrating systems. I mean, something as fundamental as reproductive justice should not come down to whether or not one person is still alive. It's an appalling sort of situation when you do it in that regard,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would just have to say lifetime appointments are problematic to me.
I would agree.
Because, you know, you get the wrong person in there and you can't get him out. And just from my experience in the workforce, right? I mean, there are people who, at a certain point, are no longer really the best fit for an organization. And so, because we don't have that here, we have to come up with a new solution. And I think in the end, it's going to be a really, really nasty fight. I think it's going to be a nasty fight. And in order to even expand the court or even potentially bring in D.C. and Puerto Rico as new states, mm-hmm. With representation for their taxation, there would have to be a huge political battle on the Senate floor, in the House in the House and Congress. And so, you know, at some point we have to think about, oh my goodness, how do we prepare ourselves for this looming battle that really is the only option? Otherwise, we roll back the United States, you know, 40, 50 years. And I don't know, I don't want to live in that United States necessarily.
Abe, we have Robbie on the line.
We have Robbie on the line. Robbie, good morning. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I was going to just mention the whole anarchist jurisdiction thing actually is
sure.
stuff that nation states use to describe insurgents inside their thing. So depending on how this election goes, we may see activists considered as insurgents because of these jurisdictions that the government is now doing. So that's kind of a really scary scenario. There's these stingrays that they put all around downtown. They're cloning your phones. Certain people with inside the DHS have actually quit working for the feds because of how Big Brother surveillance scary stuff's going on. Anyway, that's one thing that I wanted to bring up. The second thing, though, is this whole, you know, the Supreme Court thing. I'm just so upset that we're just playing this system's game. Because what I see is an undemocratically appointed life-term, life-term appointed person. And at what point do we start restructuring these government things in place? Because all I see is doing is falling victim to the same game that we've been doing for the last, you know, I guess ever since it's been established. But I don't see why we're playing this game. I just wish people would talk more about, you know, what you're about to bring up, which is packing the Supreme Court, doing all these different things through this Kafkaesque bureaucratic bullcrap. I think we really need to start challenging this power structure and looking at it. And, you know, and I hate to have this unpopular opinion, but I don't believe the notorious RBG, she kind of did us wrong. She should have retired under Obama. She wasn't at all very progressive,
yeah.
So I mean that's my opinion. But she held on to her power and didn't you know, now look at the mess that we're in. And I think that we should be really questioning the Supreme Court and its role in our, you know, judicial system, but or you know, executive, judicial, and you know, supreme. Anyway, that's all my point. I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Excellent call. Yeah, I mean. This is Exhibit A in the difficulties of navigating a 21st century world with an 18th century operating system. And that's what our constitutional order is. This was a set of rules for governance drafted in the pre-industrial age. And this is just one area out of very, very many where we are bumping up against the limitations of that. Yes, the Supreme Court is incredibly undemocratic. These people are not elected. They serve for the rest of their lives. And they were, you know, compelling reasons to make it that way back in the late 18th century, because, you know, a life term usually meant until you were 50, if you were lucky.
Right.
Right. And that is not the world we live in anymore. A life tenure, I agree with you, Tracy. It's time to revisit that thing. I agree with the caller. It's time to revisit many, many aspects of the operating software under which we live. The problem is, to do that, we would need to call a constitutional convention. And the minute that, the whole process blows up. It would be next to impossible to have objective, rational, constitutional convention at this moment in time.
Because there's so much divergence of you know, how to even run the country, who the country is, what is best for the country. And I do believe that Republicans don't think about what's best for the country. I think they think about what's best for themselves and what will benefit them. But I also agree with the caller that Ruth Bader Ginsburg could have and would have been better served. We would be better served as a nation if she would have stepped down under Obama and allowed Obama to appoint another person in her place. But yet, here we are, right? And so what do we do now? I think we can do a lot of would have, could have, should have, but at this point, we don't have those options. So let's, what do we do looking forward? And we are in very, very challenging times. And I was saying the other day, you know, 2020 is relentless. Like, what is happening? And then there was a report that more mummies were found and have been uncovered. And I'm like, is this the curse of the mummy? Is like 2020 the curse of the mummy? Like, what is happening right now?
Actually, that explanation makes more sense than just about any other one I've heard. It's the curse of the mummy.
Yeah, my aunt lives in L.A., and there was an earthquake the night that RBG died, and she was just like, what is happening? Oh, my goodness. Make it stop.
All right. This is the Abe Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Tracy Simmons is joining me today. We are talking about a number of things, the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, also the new the designation of Portland, New York, and Seattle as anarchist jurisdictions. And more broadly, we're talking about the road forward for people with an interest in progressive governance and the health of representative democracy as we understand it. And one thing we seem to be getting at kind of obliquely, Tracy, is that representative governance as we understand it perhaps is insufficient to meet the challenges of the world we face right now. The question, of course, is these sorts of things are very, very difficult to undo, very, very difficult to change. We were, in retrospect, incredibly fortunate to have convened the Constitutional Convention when we did and drafted the Constitution when we did. It's an archaic document now. That's absolutely true. But to think that we'd be able to duplicate anything resembling those conditions and come up with anything even approaching a progressive document for our common governance at this moment in time, I think is out of the question. I mean, can you imagine, even if you did it completely rationally, say, let's say we wrote an algorithm, right, and we directed that algorithm to select representatives for the upcoming constitutional convention. And we could sort and select for all sorts of criteria. We could say, you have to have X level of education. We want this group of people to exactly mirror the democratic or the demographic makeup of the United States. We want people between ages X and Y. We could select for all of these things, right? And as soon as we did that, the entire process would immediately be vulnerable to corruption by money. Exxon would step in and buy up as many delegates as it possibly could. General Motors would do the very same. Google and Apple and Facebook would do exactly the same thing. It's really a conundrum. If you're interested in a progressive future for this country, if you're interested in preserving the set of ecological conditions under which human beings were able to evolve, if you're interested in small things like this, it's an incredibly frustrating moment in time. Not to mention that, you know, it's dangerous to breathe the air inside and outside.
Well, my air is back to normal, thank goodness, so I could actually go outside. But yes, when we think about the environmental impact, I mean, even things like Citizens United, you just talked about the money in the process, right? And getting money and, you know, corporate personhood. Like, we will not be able to agree upon that because the people who hold power are married to that power and married to that structure that has been created. And so, you know, I think a caller last week referred to, like, I don't know how this can happen peaceably, that we move forward as such a big nation. I'm kind of like Lincoln in my thinking, like, no, the union must be preserved. But it's going to take some really big fights coming up. And, you know, there's also this thing that's looming in the background with Trump, and that, you know, last week he came on and professed that there will be patriotic education. Of course, education curriculum is sorted out and mandated and created at the local level. But here we have the President of the United States kind of touting kind of this Hitler youth education process in which we glaze over all the nasty parts of the history of the United States and only share the great part, right? So we're talking about the 1776 project. And, of course, this is in response to New York Times' 1619 project talking about when the first slaves were, you know, landed on the East Coast of the United States and all of the underpinnings of that. And it's just this incredibly open thing, the bad parts out loud, and it's racist and it's xenophobic, and it's like, let's not talk about the truth of this nation. And so with that kind of denial, I would just imagine if there were a Continental Congress or something of coming together to really think about the inception of this nation and where we want to see it go forward, there would be denial. Denial that so much of what's currently there is embedded in a power structure that subjugates so many, right? And I'm befuddled by the fact that this continues to take place. And the blinking lights are on for many of us around the fascism that we're seeing. But for other people, they're like, well, you know, yeah, patriot education.
It's really kind of breathtaking, isn't it? And that the 1619 Project represented something so dangerous, so insulting, that the conservative establishment, up to and including the President of the United States, felt compelled to enact something that they styled as patriotic education. Like, this is so dangerous. We can't talk about centering the lives of enslaved peoples and their descendants in the American narrative. Even relating that story is too corrosive to the grip we want to maintain on power. It's really, you're right, it's so straight out of the fascist propagandist playbook. It's both absurd and frightening at the same time. And again, it leaves us, those of us with a leftward bent, those of us with a progressive worldview, it's sort of at our wit's end and how to respond.
Abe, we have Barry on the line.
Yeah. We've got Barry on the line. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Abe. I'm wondering why our news media, not just cable, the news media in general, hasn't said anything about the last wishes of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that she not be appointed, someone not be appointed to her until this president was out of office. That was on Democracy Now! Yesterday.
That's I guess a nice thing for Justice Ginsburg to have wished. But if she had
retired, those were her wishes. These were her last wishes.
There's nobody legally obligated to uphold Justice Ginsburg's last wishes.
No. It's not legally uphold, but out of respect for her and everything about her.
I understand.
I'll just say that I'm sure anyone who saw the public announcement from Mitch McConnell knew that that was typed up and ready to go probably months ago. She's been sick. She's been in and out of the hospital. I would love to respect the wishes of a dying person or a dead person, recently dead person. But I think there are some of us with the integrity to do so, and those who integrity is not the world in which they live. It's not the operational and defining proposition for which they show up in the world. And here we have Mitch McConnell, who was set to go. So, I mean, I absolutely would like to honor her. The most recent news about Trump sharing with us his top pick is that that's going to happen before her burial, before Ruth Bader Ginsburg is buried, I believe, on Saturday. Trump is going to, prior to that, come out and share the name of his top pick. So there isn't any respect in this current environment for the dead. There's not respect for even the living, as we see another, you know, shoulder shrug as we pass and quickly tick past 200,000 Americans dead. A most recent number that came out said that 75% of children who are dying of COVID are children of color and children from underserved populations. So I would love that we could, you know, be a nation with integrity, but because the people who hold power and want to maintain their power are doing it with such a ruthlessness, we don't even have the ability to give Justice Ginsburg her dying wishes.
Well, Mitch McConnell is not one for integrity, for sure. That was brought out, I think, a few times. But and also, I want to ask about Joe. Why you don't have to bring out anything that is felt to be private? But I mean, just at least a small explanation why Joe left. And you said something about having a tape that you were going to play and didn't.
Okay. I've said all I'm going to say regarding the circumstances of Joe's departure from the station. The opportunity was left available for Joe to record a farewell message to his listeners.
Yeah.
And to my knowledge, that is something he has not done at this point. So, yeah, there we are.
Nothing about why he left.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to respect his privacy on this issue.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's something. But a lot of
yeah, I'm sure it's not satisfactory, but that's all I'm going to say about it.
Yeah. Sure. And I'm still wondering. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Thank you for the call. I think the caller's question, Tracy, and your response really underscores something we've been getting at all morning long, and it's helpful to evaluate the actions and words and decisions of prominent conservatives through a lens of power. That's the only reason they make any decisions anymore, and we need to understand that and consider that as soon as we enter into any interactions with them. It would be nice if we would all sit back collectively and revere Justice Ginsburg and her passing and respect her dying wishes and not replace her until after the next president has been seated. But we all know that's not going to happen. Are you kidding me? Is Mitch McConnell going to do that? Oh, I so respect Ruth Bader Ginsburg that I am going to forestall Senate hearings on her replacement until after the next president has been inaugurated or even until this president has been re-inaugurated. Of course not.
We have Pear on the line.
Of course not. Pear is on the line. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I was thinking, you know, there might be another way to deal with a conservative Supreme Court. You know, a lot of their rulings have to do with whether a law is constitutional and also whether it reflects the will of Congress. So if progressive people are able to elect a Congress that reflects their wishes, that Congress could pass constitutional laws and leave no doubt about their will. I think then the Supreme Court would have to go along with it.
Supreme Court would have to go along with it.
Well, if the law is constitutional and it accurately reflects the will of Congress, I don't see what a Supreme Court could do.
Well, I think a Supreme Court could do a lot. I mean, let's take the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act was passed by both houses of Congress and signed into law by the President of the United States. So we can conclude that that law accurately represented the will of Congress. Nevertheless, not just the Supreme Court, but lower courts quickly went to work trying to determine whether or not they could find that law unconstitutional. We need to be aware of the fact that activist courts are, that's not just a boogeyman that conservatives use to bludgeon liberals with. Courts are activists in the conservative direction as well. And I think the Affordable Care Act is a really instructive example in this regard. We cannot submit ourselves and rely upon the tender mercies of the conservative establishment. because they have no tender mercies. That's the point I'm really trying to get through today.
Well, I realize that, but point is that I think it's more feasible to make no mistake and get a Congress that reflects our will, that it's, this is more feasible than trying to enlarge the Supreme Court or all these other ways of trying to remedy the situation. I think that it seems like an easier, more feasible way of going at the problem is to get a Congress, especially, you know, the kind of the things that McConnell, who, a great place to start would be to the voters of Kentucky to vote McConnell out of power. That would be great.
Yes.
That would be a start. And that could be built up, you know, we could get a some kind of a movement going to elect a Congress that is not beholden to Trump. I mean, I think this is one avenue to consider anyway, because the others seem, you know, a lot more difficult to me. That's just sort of my two cents on the thing. You know, there is a remedy if the people are strong enough to take it.
Hey, well, thank you for the call, Perry. Appreciate
okay.
it. My sense is that these things are of a piece. Yes, there absolutely needs to be a Congress elected that more accurately represents the collective will of the American people. And we also need to expand the Supreme Court so that there is not an effective conservative veto looming over every bit of progressive legislation that we manage to pass. I think they need to be viewed as two sides of a coin. You pick your metaphor. We need to do them both, is what I'm trying to say. What do you think, Tracy?
I mean, I think we've got to do whatever we can. I honestly believe nothing should be off the table. And I've already heard rumblings of, like, well, let's impeach Trump again for his mismanaging of the COVID-19 situation. And, you know, there was published guidance around the potential for COVID-19 to be an aerosol transmitted through the air, and the CDC revoked that. They mm-hmm. withdrew that guidance. We've seen, you know, all kinds of shenanigans going on, whether with the distribution of CARES Act funding in a corrupt manner. So there's lots of things that we could do to stall out a quick turnaround for an appointment of a new justice, because that process, you know, includes hearings. And if you tie up the Senate and other hearings around a new impeachment, well, then there's that. I think we just have to really be considering all of our options. And I agree with you with regard to, you know, well, we could just, you know, vote in a really progressive Senate. And I don't think that's the answer, because a lot of these things are coming up from the lower court. And when we think about religious freedom laws and things like that, it's happening at the district court level mm-hmm. and making its way to the Supreme Court. So it's not even going through, you know, Congress at all. So this is, I don't think that's going to happen, right? That's not the only thing that should happen. We absolutely need to vote Mitch McConnell out, and I hope the people of Kentucky can see that he has been absolutely nothing for them and done everything against anything that was progressive and could potentially benefit them, because Kentucky is one of the lowest economic developers in the country as far as, you know, the regular men in Kentucky, regular people in Kentucky, experience great poverty. There has been no expansion of Medicare. There has been, you know, no expansion of you know, civil rights within the state because of the stronghold that Mitch McConnell and his cronies have on the economic power. And so if the people of Kentucky would stand up and say no more, we would solve a lot of our problems, because he has been one of the biggest barriers to progress in the last 10, 15 years.
We have Kyle on the line.
Yeah, in fact, I think he could accurately describe the political era we're in as the McConnell era. I think he looms larger than almost any other figure. I mean, you have enormous aberrations like Donald Trump, but, you know, in terms of his longevity and his influence over basic political processes, this has been McConnell's era, as there's no doubt about it. And let's not forget, I'm glad you mentioned the lower courts, because You know, McConnell has had some free time because he hasn't been passing any COVID relief legislation or any environmental legislation or any really other, any other kind of legislation at all. So he's had plenty of time to confirm federal judges and has really been doing nothing else in the recent past. So this is a huge problem. It's not just the Supreme Court where the presence of conservatives is going to be a problem going forward. It's at all levels of the federal judiciary. It's a huge problem, and it's something that is going to bedevil us in the years to come. Let's go to the phones. Who do we have next?
Kyle.
Kyle, good morning. Good
morning. Interesting conversation, salient, of course. Even more salient, of course, I think would be to have a good historian online right now. Somebody named Joe may perhaps would be a good guy to have right now to listen to really get some context of what happened in the previous United States history. And we don't have that guy right now, and I kind of wanted to hear where he's at and what he's doing. As a matter of fact, I'm going to hold my KBOO donation until I find out what the hell he's going to be doing and where he's at.
Well, that certainly is your prerogative. It's
yep.
True. Well, I'll just say it again. He's healthy. He's departed the station. He's been offered an opportunity to record a message to his listeners, but he hasn't done so.
Yeah, well, I'll have to
Thanks
maybe
for the call.
Call Channel 8. Maybe I'll call Kyle LaBoshi and have him come and investigate. Investigate.
Thank you for the call.
That would be
we have George in line.
Oh, yeah, all of a sudden it's history time, huh? Okay. Well.
Yeah, let's go to George. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Abe. And I just have a question or a remark, and am quite interested in what you would say to this. It's a mere footnote to what you've been talking about, but I would say, yes, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a very different sort of person, and Donald Trump is a so far different person. We would certainly say we have a lot of continuity apart from Donald Trump. And I was beginning to think, you know, I think the continuity is not so much the people. It's the damn system, which we call late-stage capitalism. But what would you say to that?
Did our current difficulties flow from the fact that we're immersed in late-stage capitalism?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, that...
I would agree with that statement.
I'm sorry?
I said I would agree with that statement. It's a very broad statement, but yes, I think it's true.
Well, I want to thank you because that's something that I'm sure glad a lot of people are beginning to wonder about this, you know, that whether not only old people get cancers they got rid of, but societies get cancers like late-stage capitalism, and somehow seeing through it and getting rid of it is one hell of an ordeal. It involves all kinds of things. One has to kind of change one's perceptions and habits. So that's my comment. I sure want to thank KBOO. Bless you folks, and hang in there. And goodbye.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that call.
Thanks.
There's a lot to unpack there. Yes, societies, especially as they become wealthy and decadent, tend to experience the sort of corrosive effects of that wealth and wealth concentration upon the mechanisms of the government. We can look at examples throughout history of this. The difference now is that, you know, we're talking about late-stage capitalism, but this is industrial capitalism, and we've never really seen a society as large and as wealthy as ours that is immersed in the mode of industrial production experiencing these sort of tectonic forces. In many ways, this is a new situation. And
I would say the late-stage capitalism is leaning into oligarchy, right, where there are very few people with a lot of money who are holding on to all of the power.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And if we narrowed down, you know, if you ask the broad question, what is the root cause of the failure of the American political system to adequately look after the welfare of all of its citizens, to permit life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to as broad a swath of the American population as possible? What is getting in the way? And the simplest answer, the most irreducible answer, is money. If you have money, it amplifies your speech. You're able to, if I'm a billionaire, for example, and I decide to give, you know, $2 million, let's say, I'm going to donate $2 million to various congressional races and to state government races around the country this year. Why would I not make that investment if I can get a return, you know, 100 times or 1,000 times greater because I was able to get a regulation successfully removed that a allows my business to be more profitable. Why would I not make that investment? And once you reach that paradigm, that means that the apparatus of your government is no longer serving the broad swath of the electorate. It is serving the interests of those people who are best able to sustain it. And that is a situation we've been in for decades now. And there's really no clear and easy way out. What's your take on that, Tracy?
It's true. I mean, and I think something in the 2016 election, it was, I mean, like 2% of all households, and we're talking about the richest 2% of households, were the donors who eventually brought us to the final candidates. And so you see this concentration of wealth that allows you to do things in the political sphere, whether that, if we want to talk about Louis DeJoy and what he did with the Postal Service and what he continues to do to dismantle the Postal Service. He got there because he had a lot of money to donate to Donald Trump's campaign, and Donald Trump did him a favor and said, hey, you know, pledge your loyalty to me and I'll get you a job, I'll get you a sweet gig, and then you can continue to diminish the opportunity for people to have their votes counted by, you know, messing with the Postal Service. And so we see, you know, there are so many obvious opportunities for people with a lot of money to use their power in ways that diminishes the voices of regular everyday people. And so then, you know, eventually the government isn't really representing those people. The people who have less power, who have less money, are now pawns. And what has happened structurally is that rich people, through the process of indoctrination into racism and other forms of othering, have told other people who are poor that, hey, you're like us. You're one of us. Even though, you know, they would never potentially, you know, engage in deep and meaningful relationships with any of these people. But, hey, vote for us. We're going to take care of you. They never do. But because you're like us and you could potentially be one of us, vote for us. And people continue to vote against their own interests and support the very rich people who have power and really are stabbing themselves in the foot, because at the end of the day, they are not able to ever reach that kind of level of wealth, and they will continue to be pawns in this game. And so it continues replicating itself over time. And I think there has to be some kind of awakening, and it won't happen through a patriotic education.
No, it most definitely won't happen. I think George Carlin nailed it when he said, there's a big old club and you and I ain't in it.
Never, we're going to be in it.
No, we're never going to
be in it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. You're right that people have been convinced to vote against their own self-interest for literally since the nation was founded. And usually it's by somebody playing off of societal differences. You know, we've been over this in previous shows, you and I. But it's there. It's all of these structural flaws that we have allowed to widen and fester over many decades in this country have been laid bare in recent days by a host of things, not least of which is an unprecedented once-in-a-century public health emergency, the growing cost of environmental degradation, and the awareness amongst the bulk of the population that the criminal justice system has been putting its boot upon a significant chunk of the American people forever. So all of these things are coming to the fore at the same time while we're being led by a fool. So, you know, if you're wondering why we're so up in arms, that's why.
Yeah.
And I think we're probably going to have to leave it there as we are out of time. I want to thank everybody for contributing to the conversation today. I'd also like to encourage you to contribute to this radio station today. Visit KBOA.fm and click on the donate button. Tracy, thank you once again for joining us today. Love having you as part of the program.
Thanks, Abe.
Thanks, everybody. And
sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
You You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.